Former Senator John Ashcroft testifies today before his former colleagues on the Senate Judiciary Committee. Ashcroft has been nominated for Attorney General, and the hearings are expected to be contentious. It won't be the first time a nominee has taken fire. In fact, Americans have come to expect contested nominations in recent years. NPR's Barbara Bradley reports on some past confirmations.
In more cordial times, the president would present his choice for a cabinet officer, and almost without exception, the Senate would advise and consent. That changed after Watergate. The parties realized that they were entering an era of split government, with one party controlling the White House and the other controlling Congress. So senators began asking more piercing questions of the president's nominee. Consider, for example, the case of Edwin Meese, Ronald Reagan's choice for Attorney General. Democrats balked at Meese for what they saw as questionable ethics. Meese was contrite in his confirmation hearings in 1985.
If I had the chance to do over some of the things that we've talked about, I would do them over. But you can't relive history. And the decisions that were made at the time were made based upon the most honorable intentions and acceptance of the highest standards that I knew at the time.
But that was not enough for some Democrats like Joseph Biden.
I acknowledge you can't relive history, but why do you stick to the technicalities of saying, for example, there in the meeting where McKean's name came up, it was not a formal meeting? Who the heck cares whether it was a formal meeting? It's irrelevant whether it was a formal meeting. You are a man who's going to be Attorney General of the United States.
Still, the Senate approved Meese because the Senate still showed deference to the president. 2.5 years later, the gloves came off when President Reagan nominated Robert Bork to the U.S. Supreme Court. The Bork nomination saw a new phenomenon, the involvement of interest groups.
When we started on July 1st of 1987, everyone said it can't be done.
Ralph Neese was then head of the Leadership Conference on Civil Rights. For the next 10 weeks, he says, more than 300 organizations joined to oppose the conservative jurist. They rallied millions of members and formed a tsunami of opposition.
We shared information, we shared resources, and of course we shared a common strategy to pursue a common goal, and that was blocking the nomination of Robert Bork to the Supreme Court.
By the time the Senate Judiciary Committee met to consider Bork, most of the positions were hardened. Democrat Ted Kennedy led the campaign against Bork. Kennedy said that Robert Bork's America would turn back the clock on civil rights.
Time and again, in his public record over more than a quarter of a century, Robert Bork has shown that he is hostile to the rule of law and the role of the courts in protecting individual liberty.
Bork testified for 5 days, outlining his legal views in minute detail and arguing that he would respect legal precedent. But the damage had been done, and the Senate rejected Bork 58-42. Bork's nomination was a turning point in the nomination process. In fact, it became a verb, to bork, as in to eviscerate someone for his ideology. Still, no one could know how rancorous a judicial nomination could become.
This is not American. This is Kafkaesque. It has got to stop.
Clarence Thomas was nominated to the U.S. Supreme Court in 1991. Thomas was a conservative African-American, and liberal interest groups didn't quite know what to do with him. They failed to mobilize as quickly as with Bork. Then a former employee of Thomas, Anita Hill, accused him of harassing her and peppering his conversation with sexual innuendo. Thomas called the hearings a, quote, high-tech lynching.
I'm not here to be further humiliated by this committee or anyone else, or to put my private life on display for prurient interests or other reasons. I will not allow this committee or anyone else to probe into my private life. This is not what America is all about.
President Bush stood by Thomas. So did Senate Republicans, who were incensed about Thomas's treatment and still angry about Bork. The Senate passed the nomination 52-48. Thomas's nomination process was unusually fierce, but the Senate has always put judicial nominees through more of a grilling than cabinet officers, because federal judges can serve for life. By the late 1980s, however, political appointees also faced a more restive Senate. The shift came with former Senator John Tower, President Bush's choice for defense secretary. Tower initially looked to be a shoo-in. The Senate never rejects a former colleague. That is, until the testimony of conservative activist Paul Weyrich.
And over the course of many years, I have encountered the nominee in a condition, lack of sobriety, as well as with women to whom he was not married. And, you know, I encountered it frequently enough to the point where it made an impression.
His testimony was a bombshell. Republicans were irate, but Tower had not been popular among his colleagues, and so, Wyrick says, he gave them an excuse.
It took somebody to do what I did to allow the cover, if you will, for others to come forward then, and of course that was the turning point.
The next day, Democrat Sam Nunn asked Tower about his attitude toward alcohol.
You have assured us, and I would privately, and I would hope you would also give us in public your own view towards alcohol and whether you yourself have any alcohol problem.
I have none, Senator. I'm a man of some discipline.
But not enough for the Senate, which rejected Tower 53-47. Historians say the Tower nomination opened up a whole new area of scrutiny, the nominee's personal life. 4 years later, Bill Clinton's choice for Attorney General, Zoe Baird, was felled because she had employed an illegal immigrant. In that case, the opposition was bipartisan. But when it came to law professor Lonnie Guinier, President Clinton's choice for the Civil Rights Division, Republicans found their moment. Clint Bullock, at the Conservative Institute for Justice, was the architect of the campaign against Guinier. As soon as she was nominated, he pored over her writings. He dubbed her the Quota Queen, portraying her as an extremist, just as liberal groups had done with Bork.
In Bork's case, it was his views on privacy. I thought that the liberal groups raised some legitimate concerns that resonated with real people. We did exactly the same thing in the Lonnie Guinier context, where she had referred to democracy as simple-minded notions of majority rule. So we were able to take some very abstract philosophical arguments and make them very tangible to mainstream Americans.
It worked. A few days later, Bill Clinton withdrew the nomination, saying if he had read Guinier's writings, he would not have selected her. For her part, Guinier said not even her mother would recognize her, the way she was depicted by conservatives and in the press.
I am a Democratic idealist who believes that politics need not be forever seen as I win, you lose, a dynamic in which some people are permanent monopoly winners and others are permanent, excluded losers. Everything I have written is consistent with that.
Lonnie Guinier was not the last nominee to be targeted by conservatives. 4 years later, James Hormel was nominated to be ambassador to Luxembourg. But religious conservatives opposed him because he is openly gay, and President Clinton gave him a recess appointment. One of Hormel's most vocal critics was John Ashcroft. Now that Republicans control the White House, the tables have turned once again. John Ashcroft's nomination battle is expected to be fierce. Barbara Bradley, NPR News, Washington.